Primary Purpose, Fort Lauderdale, Big Book Study Group, Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name's Steve. Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start a two-minute meditation, so please take a minute to get situated, turn off any devices that are going to make noise or distract other people. Take this time to get connected to God, let the craziness of the day drift away, and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. If everybody's ready, we'll get started with meditation. Like to join me, we have a fog light prayer. It's in the chair in front of you if you don't know it, or I think up on the thing behind me. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light, so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. Amen. There's a solution from the Big Book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out, which we can absolutely agree, and which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news that this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Dylan to read Spiritual Experience. We read this because of the main step, the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important that we know what one is. Uh,
Hi, I'm Dylan. I'm a recovering alcoholic. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality can change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what psychologist William James calls educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life. That such a change could hardly have been brought by him himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle, which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation, said by Herbert Spencer. Alcoholics Anonymous, page 567 through 568.
Thank you, Dylan. Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. We have a tech-free meeting, so set your phones to airplane or meeting mode or just shut them off for the duration. It's my privilege to introduce the speaker for tonight. I've spent the better part of the week thinking about what I could say, and I've got, you know, three or four of the mentors that have helped bring me through this program, this way of life, in the room right now, and it's just a privilege to be here and hear what they have to say. So I just want to bring Joe up with no further ado.
Good evening, everybody. I'm an alcoholic and a member of the Wednesday Night Big Book Study Group. My name is Joe. Hi, it's really good to be here, and wow, it is really bright up here, isn't it? My goodness gracious. I was telling Mike earlier that, you know, I have cataracts, and I plan on having an operation here pretty soon, but I can't see anyway. But I can see, you know, the front space, but that's about it. Anyway, I just want to thank Mike for inviting me to do this. It's such an honor to get to do this. It's an awesome responsibility. And I really feel that responsibility comes with being commissioned by God to carry a message that has such depth and weight. It's so important to deliver the proper message, to deliver the message of not only hope, but truth. In accuracy, and so that you understand it. I mean, I was very ignorant when I got here. I was one of those guys that always pretended to know what you were talking about, and I had no clue what you were talking about. I I was a master chameleon. You know, I would always, I always prided myself on being able to adapt to whatever situation it was and become the person that I needed to be. So I thought that would gain your grace, gain your friendship, gain your confidence, and all of it was just nothing more than a method of really trying to satisfy something within me, you know, to get that feeling of belonging and feeling of trust so I could hurt you in the process or get what it is I thought I needed. By the time I got here, as one of our books talks about, all my scorecards read zero. And I want to tell you a little bit about how I got to that point, how I got to the point of complete bankruptcy and feeling like an absolute zero and an absolute nobody inside. And by the time I got here, death was way more attractive than living. To go one more day, one more minute, I had lost all reason within me, desire within me to live. And it had nothing to do with my upbringing. It had nothing to do with my parents or any of that stuff. And I hope to be able to describe, most importantly, in this first step, you know, not just what we admit we are, but why I can admit that I am. I think that's terribly important for all of us to understand. It was easy for me for many years to acknowledge that I was an alcoholic. You know, it made sense to me from hearing what happened to everyone as a result of what happened after they drank. You know, the consequences, the behavior, all that stuff that comes as a result of drinking. But I had no idea why I was an alcoholic when I wasn't drinking. I had no idea of the condition, physically and mentally, within me that lie within my skin, stone cold sober. Because I had gotten stopped many times, but I never could stay stopped. So I hope to kind of bring you up to speed about a little bit about my life and what happened to me and, you know, the path that God laid out for me that led me to this podium on this night with you. So, I alluded to this internal condition. I didn't start drinking until I was 13 years old. I don't know what it is about 13, but a lot of people start when they're 13. But I had started to develop the internal condition. You know, a lot of people say they're alcoholic, and they believe they were alcoholic, or had alcoholism from a very early age. I don't quite understand that, given the actual definition of alcoholism. But I can tell you this, that because of the internal condition that I started to develop very early on, I had primed myself to be perfect for developing alcoholism the minute I drank. And what I mean by that is that, you know, there's this internal condition that I'll hopefully define for you and describe for you that absolutely comes before the obsession of the mind. What it does is it creates this fertile ground, this real fertile thing within me that makes me completely vulnerable and without defense when the obsession takes over. And I believe unless that internal condition is rectified and investigated and interrupted and corrected, that I will always succumb to the desire. I will always succumb and fall victim to the obsession of the mind, which ultimately leads me into drinking and the demise that comes after that. But I had come from a good family. I was born and raised up north, West Palm Beach. About 45 miles from here. And to a good family, great father, very religious man, had developed some resentments about that. But I had five sisters. I still have all five of my sisters. One is, I'm 60, and one of my sisters is 72, and there's only one younger than me, so, but they're all fantastic, great relationships still today. My brother had passed about 3 years ago from cancer, and he was 10 years older than I. Growing up, he had gone to boarding school and that type of thing, so I never really had the mentorship from my brother growing up as a little guy. Most of the things that I found out about really came from the kids on the street, you know. And so, you know, I don't know where this inadequacy feeling came from, this uncomfortable feeling that I had around people came from. It certainly didn't have anything to do with the upbringing that I had. It just had to do with me. And, you know, I had developed this thing, so I felt kind of awkward, you know, and I didn't really start noticing that until, you know, 9, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old in that neighborhood, where I started to feel uncomfortable around other kids. And the reason I say that is because I started to feel that I had to pretend to be somebody that I wasn't in order for you to like me. And I know a lot of people identify with that. But what happens at that point when I start to pretend to be someone else in order for it to be liked or recognized or validated or applauded or given credit for something, is that I start to actually steer away from ever being able to possess authenticity, to become the real me, to become the truthful me, and be able to live that way without fear of self-made up ridicule from you, right? So, nonetheless, it's when I was in school and I saw some things that I desired. I grew up in a family that taught me about God. That, you know, I was in parochial schools. I was somewhat educated on the God thing in a particular religion, and pretty much indoctrinated into that, and told that I was that, and that I should never venture away from that. And at the time, I never questioned that. You know, I never raised my hand or went to mom or dad and said, "Hey, you know, I'd like to go down to the temple with Joey and see what that's all about." When I was 11 years old, I you know what I mean? I didn't think that was even possible. But I saw some things that were happening with certain people and certain groups of people that attracted me. And one was the people that were the rebels, you know what I mean? The people that were doing things to be noticed. I wanted to be noticed. I wanted to be noticed. I wanted to be noticed and recognized for being with this group, because that was the talk of the class or what have you. And it was the people that were going away from good value, good ideals, appropriate ways of being, respectful ways of being, considerate ways of being, because behaving opposite to those, you got recognized for it. Not in a good way, but by other kids, right? So I started to go that path, and I started to go against the things that I was taught, and started to really do things that were, I knew were wrong, you know, and I knew were troubling to my parents, and you know, but I didn't really start to suffer consequences until I got into high school, and then I started to get suspended and in trouble, a lot of trouble, and but I still desired to be, you know, grouped with those people. And all the while that I'm doing that, I'm still feeling awkward that I'm really not them, you know, that I'm really not it, that I'm really not what they're being recognized for. But I'm pretending, right? So I start to create this double identity. The book talks about it. It talks about being the actor who wants to run the whole show, this person that lives a double life, And that was, you know, that started to develop very early on. And I started to master it really early on. Especially when I got out of high school. I mean, I got my first DUI in my senior year of high school. So consequences began very early on as a result of drinking. After I got out and I started to get into school, I mean, I started to get into the workplace and this and that and the other, my father had, you know, I was kind of lost. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I was going to community college. I really had no desire. I didn't have a desire to really become something. You know what I mean? I was just like living for the times, getting high, drinking, and that was it. You know, I really had no desire to be responsible or accountable or disciplined or committed or any of that stuff. I just really was starting to exist to get loaded and hang out with friends that got loaded and do things that, you know, could be loaded at. And so when it came to career, when it came to work, when it came to future, that wasn't even like in my deal, you know. And my father probably saw this, and he was friends of the local funeral director. And my brother at that time had already gotten into that business and started doing very well at it. So my father suggested I do that. And I tell you this because it had an extreme effect on me for many, many years, and it created some really deep-seated resentments towards my father and my family and so forth, and my identity. In order to please him and do something to earn income, I went to work for that funeral director. I ended up really feeling the need to live up to their expectations and be the guy that my brother had been and chasing that and this and that. And it was dark, to say the least. It was completely against anything that I thought I would ever want to do. And even though I could separate in my mind the ability to help people through the most troubling part of their life, you know, in that situation, there was still the dark aspect to it that really disturbed me. And, you know, I'm having to explain this to my friends. I'm having to pretend and be this other person and say things that were not true. And so I had really developed this internal condition, and my drinking had spiraled out of control. Through the next 15 years, it really got out of control. And, you know, I had developed the allergy to alcohol very early on. I mean, when I say that I started to suffer consequences, I started to get incarcerated and do crimes and things of that nature, that, you know, you carry that stuff around. So anyway, I mean, you know, the bad behavior and all that stuff went on, but the internal conditions still begins to really take off and really fester. And, you know, through hurting people and through abandoning, you know, certain principles and values that I was taught, I didn't realize that I started to harbor manifestations or symptoms of those consequences of hurting people and stealing from people, manipulating people, and deceiving people, especially my family and my mom and dad and so forth. And you know, I didn't learn those symptoms until I got here, and I heard what you know, and I read, and I really dove into this thing. You know, when you disrespect people and are inconsiderate and continually lie habitually to people and deceive them and steal from them and hurt them emotionally, you start to harbor. I started to harbor these symptoms, and the symptoms I have identified as what the book identifies. Fear, number one. Terrified, right? Terrified that I would be found out, that somebody would, that they would call me on my game. Shame, terrible shame. Regret, remorse, unbelievable guilt. By the time I was in the late 80s, I had ended up on the streets of Fort Lauderdale. And really it was because my family didn't want me in West Palm Beach anymore. they were disgusted with me, as I was disgusted with me. And I was that guy on Broward Boulevard. You know, people talk about their drug of choice and how you do that in treatment. Hey, what's your drug of choice, Nick? You know, and my SOC, my street of choice, was Broward Boulevard. I was the guy that you see when you drive up and down Broward with all his earthly possessions in a Publix bag, aimlessly wandering nowhere. And I did that for 16 years, on and off. The times I was off the street, it was because the House of Hope may have taken me in for a little while, or the mission, which I don't think anybody in here even recalls, but also Salvation Army, of course. And so, I mean, that was my life, and I had become addicted to crack. I was drinking out of control, and I was taking anything to kill and numb that internal condition. I didn't really know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous or the disease and how it affected me. I knew what I was. You know, I knew I was, I could identify that I was an alcoholic, that I couldn't manage my life properly, that my mind wasn't working properly. And I believe that unmanageability literally comes, I mean, it came from me way before I picked up a drink. Unmanageability came from me as a result of a terrible internal condition where I was riddled with guilt, shame, remorse, you know, and fear and all loneliness and all that stuff. Not only that, but I think the worst part about my internal condition is that I felt like such a loser. You know, after going in, you know, I never went in to detox and came out and relapsed. You have to relapse from something. You have to recover from something in order to relapse from it. So I like to say I was detoxing and retoxing. That's all I did. I never changed in between. I never understood that you had to change. So, I would go in and I would come out, go in and out, and through this, you know, in this interim, I started to feel like such a failure. You know, I would go in, I would get into halfway, and I would build the trust of my parents and my family, and they'd be so happy that, you know, my God, you know, because they felt I had such promise, you know, such ability and talent and personality. And then, you know, 3-6 months later, I'd be drunk again and on the street, and it would tear them apart. And I didn't know why. And so I was in this process, and I felt like such a failure and such a loser and so lonely. You know, I had become the lone wolf. Talks about that in the book. Bill talks about it. And the worst part about that and feeling like I would never be forgiven, I just had that feeling. People are forgiving. But I didn't think they would forgive me. Because I wouldn't have forgiven me. You know, so I was looking at people and felt they could see right through me. You know, that they could see that. Whatever I felt about me, that's how I thought the world viewed me. And it was terrible. So I mean, the only thing that would work for me was oblivion. The only times at a certain point in my drinking that I was, I never was sober. The only time I wasn't drinking was when I was passed out, but I was still intoxicated. The worst part about that internal condition, where you're suffering from all that stuff and harboring that on the inside, is pretending to everybody on the outside that it doesn't exist, that it's not real. How you doing, Joe? I'm great. And be dying inside. I hated me. I couldn't look in the mirror in my eyes. It was too dark. So by the time I got here, death was way more attractive. Way more attractive. Until I finally, God, in His love and grace and mercy, whispered enough in my direction. There's two really important dates in the last 15 years for me. One is September 14th of 2002. The other is October 21, 2014. It's important with this beast that we are prepared for anything. And in 2002, I had my last drink. I had my last hit of crack. Any other illicit drugs other than pain medication. Still to this day, but the date has changed. I have fallen head over heels in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful and in awe of what's in this book that we call our basic text, that Bill called our basic text, which means that it's a book of instruction, right? It's a textbook. Time we get in school that we study, not that we just read. I didn't understand that. I thought that was only for really serious people that were seriously addicted. Not drinking and going to meetings was just fine for me, right? But I was leading big book studies. I was sponsoring men. I was very much, and I'm still a trench warfare kind of guy. You know, I love the trenches. It's what I do. I feel comfortable there, helping men find the light, find His grace, and I had developed a pain in my side actually 3 years ago, last month, 3 years ago, and I was suffering from a disease called diverticulitis, and the doctor kept saying, "Well, no, it's just the diverticulitis. You're just having issues with that." And the third CAT scan, I said, Doc, there's something growing in here. And it's not the diverticulitis, symptoms. The first two scans were dry scans. The third scan was a wet scan. And I'm driving home at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon. Everything seemed to be fine. On the outside, and for the most part, and I got a call from him. He said, "Joe, you need to go to the hospital immediately." He said, "Don't even go home to get clothes. Don't even get a change of clothes." He said, "You need to go right now, go through the emergency room, and we need to do surgery. You've got an abscess on your colon under your diaphragm the size of a baseball, and if it pops, you're going to have sepsis and die." And completely blindsided me. It terrified me. But so I went to the hospital, and 11 hours later, I wake up from the surgery. I come to in the recovery room. It was an 11-hour surgery where they had taken several feet of my colon. And I woke up with a colostomy bag in my stomach over here and a catheter and couldn't get out of bed. And there I was. And at that moment, I had some decisions to make to rally the support of the people that adored me and loved me and that were in my support group, or not. And I decided to really not be aggressive in that, that comes from being complacent. It comes from letting down your commitment, and where the fire was actually starting to dwindle out. And I had some issues with my church and some stuff that happened that really to where I compromised in a few areas. And little did I know, an internal condition started to develop that I wasn't addressing. And I'm here to tell you that this thing can come at you every which way. And people would say, I had 3 major surgeries within the span of 6 months. And life-saving. I mean, they were life-threatening, life-saving. And when I came to in the recovery room, after that first surgery, I was hooked up to morphine. I was being given pain medication and this and that and the other. And little by slowly, I would have people come. And I knew that, at that point, the genie's out of the bottle. I'll explain what happens with that. That I really needed to either be aggressive or passive. And I chose to be passive. And this thing is bigger, way bigger than I can possibly imagine or describe, as you know, probably. And people say, "Well, why did you change your date? You were in the hospital, you had da-da-da-da, medical procedures, and you had to take medicine and all this stuff." because the fact was, is I knew that the allergy had me, and I knew that the obsession of the mind had me. And how could I, from that point forward, live a lie and get sober again, right? All right, so that brings you up to date. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this thing that lies within our skin that is that I believe is an absolute death sentence. And that unless it's interrupted and we do the work necessary in order to recover from this thing, that we are going to die an active alcoholic and drug addict. No question about it. And we're going to die a very miserable, sad, depressing, lonely death. As many people, as a matter of fact, as 50,000 did last year from drug and alcohol related deaths. This thing's winning, people. It's kicking butt. And if we don't recover from the hopeless condition of the mind or body, we are absolutely going to use again. If we think we can just come to some meetings and stay abstinent and gain some physical sobriety, we are going to get loaded again. If you're a real alcoholic and a real drug addict, okay? If you suffer from addiction and alcoholism. So, Dr. Silkworth treated Bill Wilson. Bill was a multiple detoxer. You know, he did that rodeo too. I just did it way many more times than three. And Dr. Silkworth, they say, treated well over 40,000 of us. And he noticed some things. He saw some patterns. And he saw some things that really puzzled him. So he came to some conclusions as to what he saw and witnessed in our behavior and what happened when we would drink. And he noticed, first of all, that when he came in, when, you know, there was only detox back at that point. It was either that or an insane asylum or an asylum or jail, right, or death. And he would bring us in. He would get us undrunk and undrugged through whatever method of treatment he needed to do. He would walk through the door and say, good luck. That's all you could do. There was no AA or anything like that. And these are people, just like us, that had tremendous promise, had acquired many, many things materially, career, family, children, possessions, all of that stuff. And in light of some foolish reason, we decided to take a drink, or they decided to take a drink, and they couldn't stop. So he noticed this distinction between certain types of drinkers, moderate drinkers, heavy drinkers, and then us. And because he treated all of them. In our book, it says that moderate drinkers can take it or leave it alone anytime they want. You know, moderate drinkers are those kind of people that will drink a half a drink, start to get a little tipsy and out of control, and go, whoa, I don't want no more of that. Right? Most of them drink for relaxation. Heavy drinkers look just like us, or users, right? They look just like an alcoholic. They may suffer physically. They may need medical attention, right? They may get DUIs and get arrested and so forth. Some of them end up in AA, right? And stay. But these people too, given an operative reason, right? Given a sufficient reason for them to do the about face, they can stop or moderate as well. But the real alcoholic and the real addict, and I always include addiction because all the kids today have, you know, substance abuse problems. I did. I'm 60. Right? Begin to lose all control once they put it in their body. And Silkworth noticed this. He noticed that once there's this one group of people, once they began, they couldn't stop or control it. And the reason, what he did was he chose a word that really accurately describes that condition, and it's called allergy. And if you look in Webster's dictionary, it's an allergic reaction to a food, a beverage, or a substance. All right? That when you put this allergen in your body, and not until you put it in your body, we have this phenomenon, he called it a phenomenal craving, right? Since the early 50s, when they started doing clinical trials and testing and research on us, they concluded that it was an actual physiological demand that was created within our body for whatever that thing is that we like to use, right? That when we put it in, we can't control the amount we take from that point forward. We have an inability to control or stop, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. So, something happens in us that doesn't happen in a normal temperate drinker, or the heavy drink, or possibly the heavy drinker, right? If you have this thing, and you're wondering if you have this thing, all you have to do is look at your drinking and drugging habits, and ask yourself that: when I put it in, was I able to stop or control it? When we were out there, we always had a predetermined amount or a predetermined time that we were going to go out and do this thing. And whenever we did it, we never held to that amount or timeline, right? And in light of all the things that we would tell ourselves, I'm only going to go out for an hour, I'm only going to do a couple, I'm only going to drink a six-pack, I'm only going to smoke a 20, whatever that is, right? Once we started, we couldn't stop. And towards the end, we literally had to be stopped. We had to literally be separated, right? But that's not the worst thing. That's the physical piece to this deal. All of us have stopped many times. I always tell people, you want to stop? Go slap a cop. I think now it's like 6 months you get it. Really? It used to be 90 days. I mean, if you just need to physically get better so you can go do it again, just go slap a cop. Our problem is not stopping. Our problem is that we can't stay stopped. We cannot stop starting, no matter how much we stand to lose, no matter how much we have in our lives at the time. When we get stopped, we go through detox, we come into AA, we go to some meetings, everything begins to get better. We don't get pulled by the cops anymore. Mom and dad start trusting us a little bit. People say hi to us. We have some camaraderie. Things get better when we stop drinking and drugging. But the problem is, as we go through that abstinent period and we don't do anything to change, we don't engage in the program, we don't engage in the recipe that they have designed here, we continue to stay the same, right? And then all of a sudden you have this crazy thought that, God, it wasn't that bad. Nobody will know. I'll just do a little of that. I won't do that. See, this is called the obsession of the mind, this conversational thought or group of thought that we have with ourselves. We don't run it off anybody else. We have it all by ourselves. One half selling, the other half buying. And it comes in the form of a lie. It can't come in the form of anything else. Because here's what comes before that. We come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, emotional cripples, destroyed and broken, beaten beyond measure, lonely, scared to death, terrified about the past, terrified about the future, still harboring fear, regret, shame, remorse, bitterness, loneliness, the feeling like we'll never be forgiven, the feeling like a loser, feeling like a failure, and knowing everybody else knows that about me, I'm making that up. So I got to pretend that it's not even going on. How you doing? Great, I'm great. And I'm dying inside. Let me tell you something. When they take our solution away, or when we put it down, we can't numb anymore. We can't erase that feeling. And it amplifies tenfold. It's deafening. It's screaming at us. And we're trying to assure everybody and our family and everybody else and our kids, everything's fine. How you doing, Mommy? I'm all right. How you doing, Daddy? I'm okay. It's going to be okay this time. It's going to be different this time. Knowing I'm destroyed on the inside. So I go to a few meetings, I feel a little better. I don't do anything to address that condition. And then one day, it can be a clear blue sky, just like they talk about in the book. Clear, nothing on the horizon. And all of a sudden, the thought comes into my mind, God, nobody will know. See, Dr. Silkwood, he described it perfectly. He said that men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. and or whatever drug of choice you have, do, or whatever. We like the effect. Well, what is the effect? He says it in a few sentences later. But before he does that, he describes a condition. See, when I told you that the things that we do in our past that culminate and develop this internal condition of those things that I talked about, those things, the fear, the regret, the shame, the remorse, and all that stuff, have symptoms as well. There's manifestations to that stuff. He described it as being restless, irritable, and discontent. When we stop drinking a drug and we go into detox or halfway or wherever we are riddled with restlessness, irritability, and discontent. Right? He says, unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort. I was looking for ease and comfort my entire life. Since I was a little guy, when I felt awkward or disconnected or inadequate, all I wanted was a sense of ease and comfort. At 13, when I put that booze in my body, I felt ease and comfort. And we come in here, we get a little dry, we put some physical sobriety together, we don't change anything in between, we're pretending and acting like everything's okay, and we're not even displaying our true nature or our core principles, right? I was a fraud. I was a walking, talking masquerade when I got here. I didn't even know what I stood for, right? He says, after I have succumbed or given in, caved, whatever you want to say, to the desire, he alluded to it as a desire. Bill calls it an obsession. I call it an appetite, right? As so many do, we go through the stages of a well-known spree or binge, emerging remorseful, imagine that. Emerging remorseful. Oh, God. Right? With a firm resolution to never do it again. I'll never do that. It's a treatment battle cry. I'll never do that again. Nothing to make me. I'm good. Right? He says this is repeated over and over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, a.k.a. spiritual experience, a.k.a. profound alteration in our reaction to life, a.k.a. spiritual awakening, transformation, profound alteration, whatever you want to call it, there's very little hope of the recovery. Now, I'm going to tell you something. When I read that, my sponsor brought me through that, I felt doomed. I felt, how do you get one of those? How do you think different? How do you go from everything you know to be so to something else? I didn't think it was possible. It's possible. And they figured it out. But it's not possible by any earthly means. I have to first believe that it's possible. The only way I'm going to believe it's possible is to see proof. And believe you me, you look around this fellowship and you see proof all over the place. You see proof of many things. You see proof of the fellowship of the Spirit. People that are spiritually liberated from this world, outrageous, living life, living large with boundaries that you cannot encroach over, powerful people. And then you see people that are just abstinent, miserable, victims, negative. And they could be here for years, but they've done nothing to change. I have to first acknowledge if this thing is, if this beast, this physical thing and this spirit, if this physical thing and this mental thing fit for me. I just have to ask myself in so many words, if I can't stop or control it when I start, and I can't stay stopped. The first two sentences in the We Agnostics describe it. You know, if you can't stay stopped and you can't stop starting, you're probably alcoholic or suffer from the disease of addiction. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And let me tell you something. I think that this crowd is pretty intelligent, or at least smart enough to know that they say in the second set that I came to believe that only a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. The sanity that they're talking about is if I have to be restored to sanity, that would indicate that I'm insane. What is my insane? How is that displayed? Well, it's simply displayed that if I know that I can't stop when I start because of the allergy, and I know that I can't stay stopped, or I can't stop starting because of the obsession of the mind, and I have this death sentence, I know that there's nothing that I've done to date, and I'm speaking up until the time I got sober, prior to that, that whether it was a treatment center, a halfway house, jail, judge, priest, mom, dad, children, fortune, career, everything, no human being could relieve me of my alcoholism. Now, that might be a mind twister for you. It was for me. But simple terms, no human being or human institution could keep me stopped. Get it? They couldn't keep me stopped. I always started again. So they couldn't keep me stopped, and the obsession of the mind always won out because I was seeking and screaming for a sense of ease and comfort that eventually didn't come from going to the casino or from her or for him or mom and dad or whatever we chase when we first get sober to get a sense of ease and comfort. If I'm not changing, if I'm not seeking this spiritual solution, I'm going to look for something to give me a sense of ease and comfort, even if it's you acknowledging me as I'm popular or that I'm somebody, right? So if no human being has been able to keep me stopped, AA says simply, we have a way out. We're going to work out our deal on a spiritual plane. There's a spiritual solution to this thing that we have found that works. And automatically, there comes the argument. Oh man, don't approach that, right? Don't approach that. No, I'm not going to talk about that. Great. Pick your poison. How well is what you've been doing working? Right? These are things my sponsor would say to me. It's like, he didn't candy coat this thing. He said, I'd rather, step on your feelings and walk in your grave. He told me the truth. And the truth is revealed in here. The facts are the facts. I can't change the facts. I can't stop or control this thing once I begin. And if I don't clean up the internal condition, it will always lead me to believe the lie. Always. And at first, it may not be the lie of that I can put it in safely, or that I can use or drink safely. It may be that I can still do the old behavior, all the old things. I can still hang with the old people. I can still, run my mouth. I can still lie. I can still cheat. I can still be inconsiderate. I can still go to the places that, the strip clubs and mess with ladies in the night. I can do all that. I just won't drink. So, who am I? I'm the same guy that walked into detox. I know this. That guy will get loaded again. Me unchanged will get loaded again. No matter how much dry time I have, my condition gets worse as I try to treat it with just time. The act becomes bigger. The masquerade becomes bigger. So, listen. I hope something resonated with you tonight. I don't speak to those that know. I don't speak to those that are well versed in the book. And Mike is one of the best teachers there are in the universe. I'm speaking to those that don't know or have gone through this struggle for years or months or whatever, and you don't know why you ended up back here. The common denominator is change. When I'm beaten and broken enough, there's only one thing that will have me engage in this thing without argument, without negotiation, right? Without conditions. There's only one thing that will get me to that point. Booze and drugs. It's the master persuader. It's the master persuader to get me to the point where I can say, I don't know. There's only one way out. If I'm going to get something I've never gotten before in my life, I must be taught how to get it. I can't just make it up. Albert Einstein said a problem cannot be solved by the same mind that created the problem. I created all my own masquerade. I was so busy fabricating the guy that I thought I needed to be in order for you to like me and give me what I wanted, that I so far veered off the intended person that God created me to be. I have to get back to that place. I have to get back to a place of, you know, building. I have to tear it down. And the only way I'm going to do that is through this process. But I have to come to the truth. Am I powerless or am I not? You have a vacant house. I'm going to close with this. I got 2 minutes left. You have a vacant house. Just got built. Some of the infrastructure has been put in electrically. But you don't have power. There's no lights. There's no nothing in there. The wiring, all that is there. Everything's there, but the hookup. So we have everything that we need to harness the power. But we're just, you know, when we get here, we're vacant buildings with all the wiring, but the wiring is faulty and the power source is not there yet. We get to be reborn in this deal. This is not a let me get a little better, let me stop for a little while, because that would indicate that I'm still trying to gain, right? This is caterpillar to the butterfly stuff. This is transformation. This is big. It's huge. You can have it all. All. You can have everything you want as long as you make it your main goal to want Him most. And by doing this process, you're sincerely trying to grow into His reason for you being here. Right? I believe that's all He wants. It's just for us to want Him most. But we got to acknowledge first, once we know we're powerless, that is the way we're going. And next week we'll talk about that. Thanks.
Guys, let's give Joe another hand. That was awesome. I forgot how much I like listening to that stuff. I'm going to introduce John, our secretary. Right, I'm sorry.
Hi, my name is Fred, and I'm your recovered alcoholic secretary. In keeping with the seven traditional states that every group should be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. I've asked Marcus to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic. Cured of alcoholism, recovered but not cured. The presence of conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. We have been restored to sanity. This was the problem. The main problem the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than the body. We are now saying where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have a cup. '40 style Big Book sponsorship. From the fourth to the second edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experienced is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I have a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? Is there anyone in need of a sponsor tonight? Please raise your hand.
Got one here.
Can you please stand up for a minute? All the ladies who are available for sponsorship, can we please give a prayer after the meeting? Please join us Monday nights. We have a Big Book study meeting up on the third floor of the church here, where the Big Book comes alive. Fellowship is at 6:30, and the meeting itself starts at 7:15. We have large print Big Book and Big Book dictionaries for sale. We meet every Thursday starting promptly at 8:15. And we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. Thank you guys, and I'll see you next week.
All right. We have tonight's session and all the past speakers on podcast online for free at alcoholicsandgod.org. I have an announcement. Holy Thursday next week. We do not have a meeting on Thursday night. The church needs the spaces, so we will reconvene not next Thursday, but the Thursday after that. Not sure what the date is there, but no meeting here next Thursday. And we also wanted to give Steve a little send-off. He's heading up to Tampa. He's been in the area and in the trenches for a long time, and we just want to invite him back anytime he can make it. Thanks, Steve. And I'll invite everybody to our Monday night Big Book studies on the third floor of the same building here, same time. And anybody who wishes to thank the speaker, line up down the center aisle, and just thank Joe again, guys. Thanks a lot. Close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and all glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Hey guys, just a quick reminder, there's a 75-foot, no smoking, no vape in front of the door. See y'all on Monday. Godspeed. Cause they
when you smiling, when you smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby. Yes, when you laughing. When you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. So stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby, and I hope.
We'll be right back.